Hello, and welcome to Dr. M's Women and Children First podcast. This week is the Salisbury Pediatric Associate Health and Wellness Newsletter. In the audiocast version, this is volume 14, issue number 11 for the week of February 26, 2024. This week, we're going to talk about measles and then go through some literature in a review. The free thoughts. This week, I want to thank everyone for choosing to read or listen to this audiocast or read the newsletter and continue to learn and improve the lives of your children. I love it. It's a labor of love for me to do this, and the email open rate is 57%, which is greater than double the industry average, which makes me very happy that you all love this newsletter enough to do that. That being said, as always, it is my appreciation for you for doing the lifting of listening and reading and learning and growing. So thank you very much for your time. Measles. We're looking into measles again because there's been recent outbreaks, and it's good for everyone to get a review, to know, to think, to be involved in the understanding of what could potentially happen. From the CDC reports, as of the week of this newsletter, there were 35 cases of measles so far in the United States. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reported that it was including 7 direct importations of measles by international travelers and 2 outbreaks with more than 5 cases each. Most of these cases were among children and adolescents who had not received a measles-containing vaccine, even if age-eligible. In 2023, there were 58 total cases, which is a far cry from 2019 when we had over 1,274 cases. But we are still a sign that risk persists for some unvaccinated immune-compromised people. This is not gone, unfortunately. Now, again, I have yet to see measles in flesh, in person, in my clinic. But that being said, we need to keep thinking about the possibility of it showing up. So what is measles, right? Measles is a serious, highly contagious, and potentially deadly viral infection caused by an RNA paramyxovirus. It is spread primarily by contact with droplets from an infected person's nose, mouth, or throat. Sneezing and coughing can aerosolize the droplets and increase the range of infectious spread significantly. Symptoms usually develop 8 to 10 days following the exposure to an infected individual. A sick person is contagious for 4 days before and 4 days after the symptom onset. The reproductive rate of this virus is insanely high at 12 plus, meaning for one person infected, they'll infect 12. And those 12 infect 12 more, which gives you 144. Those 144 get 12 more, which is 1728. And then again to 20,736. Within 4 doublings. That is off to the races at an exponential load, which is why this virus is so incredibly virulent. Measles presents itself with symptoms of high fever, rash, cough, myalgias or muscle ache, sore throat, and red eyes. Children often look very sick. The rash begins 14 days after exposure and is characterized by red bumps that start on the head and move down the body. The illness can be mild or severe. Some children go on to get encephalitis, which is a brain inflammatory disorder that can be deadly in the acute phase. This occurs in about 1 in 1,000 cases. Other complications that are not uncommon include pneumonia of the bacterial origin, ear infections from bacteria, and sinus infections from bacteria. So the virus causes inflammation in the system, predisposing the body to be susceptible to bacterial infections, which can be deadly again. In this modern era, not so much because we have antibiotics, but the encephalitis piece is significant. Another rare but serious complication of measles is a disorder called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. And by the name, subacute means it's not immediate, but it happens relatively soon after infection. Sclerosing meaning hardening, and panencephalitis means all over the entire brain in an inflammatory manner. This is a brain disorder that occurs years after you have recovered from the virus. The immune system overreacts to the virus and slowly causes a sclerotic issue to occur in the brain tissue, leading to death. This occurs in 1 in 10,000 infected individuals. The measles rate of death is around 2 per 1,000 cases. So if you couple the encephalitis and then the secondary infections to bacteria, and then now this subacute panencephalitis, that's your risk. So 1 in 500. That is not a small number. Thus, the reason everyone's very scared about measles taking root again in this country. The deaths tend to be clustered in the children under the age of 5 and those who have immunocompromised disease states. Measles is also very dangerous for somebody who is pregnant. It can cause premature birth and miscarriage for the offspring. So again, not a good virus. Again, I have never seen this disease personally, so I'm again avidly reviewing the pictures and the clinical history so I am up to date and ready to roll. It was all but eradicated from the United States in the 1990s. My partner, Dr. Wayne Koontz, who is 85, has seen it many times during his career, during his training in Texas in the 1960s and 70s. I listen to the stories and he confirms that this is a scary player when it is active endemic. I don't have that knowledge. Again, I can only see what I read. He has firsthand knowledge and it is scary. So therefore, what's the answer? I encourage those who are not vaccinated to seriously reconsider their position on the vaccine, or at least know what the illness looks like. Be ready. Go to Google Images and look at the rash and coplex spots, which are pathognomonic for the illness. If you think that your child may or may have not have measles, it's best to get your child checked. But it is imperative that you inform your provider before you show up at the office so we can take precautions to isolate your child from potentially infecting other children in the clinic, especially those who have immunocompromised states. Even if they've had the vaccine, they could still be susceptible. Walking into the waiting room without telling us will dramatically increase the risk of viral spread, which then potentially sends us off to the races again. Let's say there's 20 kids in the room and we infect those 20. Those 20 will infect 12, and you can imagine how this number takes off again. Measles can live on inanimate surfaces for a couple hours, making it another problem. If you're in there and you leave it there, kids can come in afterwards and touch the surface and get exposed. So this is how we try and avoid contagion. Measles is not directly treatable. You can take vitamin A as prescribed by your physician to help with the illness or potentially prevent it. And that is known because vitamin A deficiency is a known risk factor for a seriously bad outcome and when infected with measles. But the bottom line is there's nothing you can really do to slow down the measles infection other than treat somebody supportively. The reason vitamin A works is because it has an effect on activating nuclear retinoic acid receptors in epithelial cells or skin cells of the gut lining or the mucus lining of hollow spaces, and also has an effect on innate and adaptive immune cells, turning them on, making them more vigilant, and then potentially killing the virus faster. These necessary responses to vitamin A are hampered in a deficiency or insufficiency state, leading to immune weakness and thus measles morbidity risk. Again, the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure rings true here. Keep adequate vitamin A stores by eating red peppers, carrots, salmon, liver, and many other sources in your system. For a concise and deeper look at immune vitamin A responses, you can go to the Linus Pauling website, and there is a really cool breakdown of the biochemistry there. And they say, in quote, vitamin A was initially coined the anti-infective vitamin because of its importance in normal functioning of the immune system. The skin and the mucosal cells, linings of the airways, digestive tract, and urinary tract function as a barrier and form the body's first line of defense against infection. Retinoic acid is produced by antigen-presenting cells, including macrophages and dendritic cells, which are these really important immune cells that engulf and kill viruses and also teach the system how to be prepared to deal with viruses. These cells are found in the mucosal interfaces and associated lymph nodes. Retinoic acid, or vitamin A, appears to act on dendritic cells themselves to regulate their differentiation, migration, and antigen-presenting capacity. In addition, the production of retinoic acid by antigen-presenting cells is required for the differentiation of naive CD4 T lymphocytes into induced regulatory T lymphocytes, the calming part of the immune system. Critical to the maintenance of mucosal integrity, the differentiation of Tregs is driven by all trans retinoic acid through RAR alpha-mediated regulation of gene expression. Also during inflammation, all trans-retinoic acid and RAR alpha signaling pathways promote the conversion of naive CD4 T lymphocytes into effector T lymphocytes, type 1 helper T cells rather than Treg cells, and induces a production of pro-inflammatory cytokines by effector T lymphocytes in response to infection. There's also substantial evidence to suggest that retinoic acid may help prevent the development of autoimmunity, end quote. What that's basically saying is, vitamin A is super, super important in turning on all the parts of the immune system that are involved in pathogen killing and the control of the immune response. So We know vitamin A is important, so you want to make sure you have adequate vitamin A on board at all times. If you have a known exposure, seek medical help for possible vaccination or immune globulin therapy, which could help prevent things from going sideways, especially if you are at high risk, like a pregnant woman, an infant younger than the age of one, or children under the age of five with weakened immune systems. Another study that was super fascinating back in 2019 shows that measles will erase some immune memory. As measles cases continue to climb worldwide, a group in the Netherlands has shown that measles virus can hijack the immune system of sick individuals, wiping out its memory to other pathogens. This is not a good thing, as this makes the individual susceptible to these infections all over again, potentially raising risk of a bad outcome. The lead author of the study in the journal Science was Dr. Mina, and she noted that 11 and 73% of circulating antibodies that protect against diseases are lost post-natural measles infection. The abstract from the article writes, quote, measles virus is directly responsible for more than 100,000 deaths yearly. Epidemiological studies have associated measles with increased morbidity and mortality for years after infection, but the reasons why are poorly understood. Measles virus infects immune cells, causing acute immune suppression. To identify and quantify long-term effects of measles on the blood immune system, we use VirusScan, an assay to track antibodies to thousands of pathogen epitopes in blood. We studied 77 unvaccinated children before and 12 months after natural measles infection. And measles was noted to cause elimination of between 11 to 73% of the antibody repertoire across different individuals. Recovery of antibodies was detected after natural re-exposure to pathogens. Notably, these immune system effects were not observed in infants vaccinated against MMR, but were confirmed in measles-infected macaques. The reduction in humoral immune memory after measles infection generates potential vulnerability to future infections, underscoring the need for widespread vaccination. Again, 2019, Mina et al. In the journal Science. The bottom line, folks, is very simple. Measles is a nasty virus. It causes significant disease in 1 per 1,000 affected individuals. Now we have strong data that it wipes out long-term immune memory in a much higher proportion of people, putting them at risk for other infections and disease. I am still convinced that vaccines are not the cause of autism. This fact stems from my 25 years of observation in clinic. I pray that this reality remains true, as vaccines are saving countless lives every year. Again, that is my opinion based on history and the science that I understand. I know that is very controversial in this day and age with some folks, but that is just what it is. Literature review, section 2. Why are women more prone to autoimmunity? Well, it turns out that a hypothesis has emerged whereby this is a molecular RNA coding called XIST, X-I-S-T, which is a long non-coding RNA sequence on the X chromosome that is immune stimulating. It turns out only to be found on one of the X chromosomes, in women only. Thus, boys and men do not have this molecular signature. The reason behind this reality has been determined to be due to XIST being involved in the inactivation of one of the two X chromosomes that a female has in every cell of her body. This inactivation prevents excess DNA transcription into proteins needed for life by expressing both copies. This process is called X chromosome inactivation and occurs at the beginnings of life and is maintained throughout life. With 4 in 5 autoimmune cases being in women, we have long wondered why. The antibody formation against XIST proteins is a lead into the why it is sex dominant. I believe that the anthropological reason is that the XIST proteins offered some protective benefit against death or for procreation of children by their mothers. Likely, these proteins provided a survival benefit for mom and her child during childbirth, which historically was a risky process from an infectious bacterial burden perspective. Some people have called this immune hypervigilance. It makes sense to me, but we need more data to prove that that is actually what's going on. Either way, it's another piece of evidence along the way. Number 2, acid-suppressing medicines are now firmly associated with development of food allergies and sensitivities. From a news article in Quad AI, they noted that there's a 6x or 6-fold increase in development of food allergies in infants that use proton pump inhibitors. Quote, we found that early exposure to acid suppressive medications was associated with a 5 to 6 times higher risk of food allergy and anaphylaxis, with similar trends observed for antimicrobials, end quote. This was stated by Julie Tanzo, which is the lead author, and her co-author, Mohamed Chaban, MD. For me, this research still begs the question of chicken or egg. I believe that this data set is a second problem. The primary issue is that these children have symptoms that push a provider to use a PPI without understanding the root cause. The issue here is that these children have intestinal dysbiosis from inherited transferred microbes that are coming from their parents, their mother, in most cases, leading to a very early 3 or 4 week old child having milk protein intolerance, soy protein intolerance, potentially corn protein intolerance, leading to reflux, colic, congestion, bloody diarrhea, and eczema. These children will improve their reflux and colic concerns taking this PPI without addressing the root problem of the disease, which is the intolerance to the food. Thus, the persistent intestinal dysbiosis and food intolerance will drive further inflammation in the gut, leading to antigen presentation that we see of as more food intolerances or true IgE-mediated allergies. If you don't deal with the root cause, the problem will not go away. You're just kicking the can down the road until the next disease shows up, and that's, I think, what we're seeing. So again, that comes from a Quad AI website that you can get the information in the newsletter. You can click the links for that one, for the Moyer Scientific American article, and for the Dolgen Nature article, as well as the Dow Cell article. Section 3 is books to consider reading or gifting to kids. For teens, I love Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink, Anything You Want by Derek Sivers, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens by Sean Covey, Make Your Bed by Admiral William McRaven, The Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday, Principles by Ray Dalio, Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley, Tuesdays with Maury, Mitch Albom, Dune, Frank Herbert, The Hobbit, J.R. Tolkien, Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan, Anything by Judy Blume, a lot of kids love that, Inspired by Susan Bernardo, The Xanth series by Piers Anthony for the younger teens, Count of Monte Cristo, a great book by Alexander Dumas. For adults, I love these books, Umberto Eco is The Name of the Rose, Anything by Bernard Caldwell, especially his series called The Lost Kingdom, The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova, fantastic version of the story about Dracula, The Deluge with Fire and Sword trilogy by Henrik Sienkiewicz, Game of Thrones series by George R. R. Martin, Daniel Suarez's Daemon, Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, A Thousand Splendid Sons by Khaled Hosseini, The Cobra Event, Richard Preston, Genesis Code, John Case, Camelot Chronicles, Jack White, one of my favorite series of all time, that one, World Without End, Ken Follett, that series, excellent, Barkskins, Annie Proulx, Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, and 1776 by David McCullough. If you want medical books, my favorites are The Inside Track by Jerry Mullen, Walls Protocol by Terry Walls, Nourish Your Tribe by my wife, Nicole Magrita, Do Fathers Matter, Paul Rayburn, Why We Sleep, Matthew Walker, Navigating Metabolism, Navdeep Chandel, ADHD Naturally, Kathy Kemper, ADHD Without Drugs, Sanford Newmark, Nurture Shock, Poe Bronson, Healthy at Home, Tierra Lowdog, Gluten Freedom, Alessio Fasano, The End of Alzheimer's, Dale Bredesen, The Disease Delusion, Jeffrey Bland, Great Kids Don't Just Happen, Paul Smolin. Parenting with Love and Logic, Jim Fay. Dare to Lead with Brené Brown. And Why Our Health Matters with Andy Weil. So that's a bunch of stuff you can look at and decide whether or not you want to read them. I find them all to be great, but that, again, as always, is just my opinion. Song of the Week, Surrendering by Candlebox, one of my favorites. All right, everyone. As always, hug those kids, and you are much appreciated. The disclaimer. The information provided in this newsletter audiocast is for educational informational purposes only. It is not a substitute for advice and or treatment provided by your physician or other healthcare professional and is not to be used to diagnose or treat a health issue. This newsletter does not constitute development or of a provider-patient relationship. Have a great day.